Good morning, I'm Neil O'Toole, representing Ms. Farmer, members of the panel of council. Yeah, I'm gonna try and break down my argument in two separate ways. The first is going to have to do with the definition of permanent total disability, which you know is found in section 8-40-201-16.5. And that's A, and it says permanent total disability means an employee is unable to earn any wages in the same or other employment. In this case, the evidence is that the claimant, at least as of the date of her injury, was able to earn wages. The amount of those wages may have not been significant, and at that time she was receiving Social Security benefits, which, as a result of the general admission of liability, were subject, those benefits were subject to be applied against the total, temporary total, temporary partial disability benefits that she was receiving. She's actually receiving temporary total, but not in a huge amount, but the Social Security was offset. Now, we do have numerous statements in the record, and I think findings of the judge, that should not have any doubt that, say, you know, it was essentially in paragraph 32, the judge said she is essentially undisputed that the claimant cannot return to work, and her findings of fact, that then she goes on to say, however, having established that, that the back injury the claimant sustained, and these are her words in paragraph 33, is not a significant factor. Not that it's not a factor, it's not a significant factor. And then she says the claimant's work injury has not contributed, nor has it directly caused her inability to earn wages. Now, her ultimate decision is the claimant's not permanently and totally disabled, and that is based on reports of Dr. Burnham, who concludes in a counterfactual way that the claimant should have never worked in the first place. The reality is the claimant was working. And
let me ask you a question about the claimant's job. Was this not a program to see if she could successfully transition back to work, and was there any evidence that she was doing so and wasn't having difficulties with that?
Having litigated this case, I do not remember there being any evidence dealing with the purpose of the Ticket to Work program, or the fact that, in fact, she failed in the Ticket to Work program and did this on her own. So the fact of the matter is, she was hired to work initially 32 hours. The employer, and gratefully, met her restrictions, and she did continue to work, had reduced hours over time, and got assistance over time, but most of the time did not get such assistance. The fact of the matter is, she was able to work, and despite Dr. Burnham's opinion that she should not have been able to, it's counterfactual. So we know that she was able to earn wages at that point. What we also know, using that definition of permanent total disability, from Dr. Gronseth, who is the dime doctor, that the claimant's limitations from her back were such that she would be limited to a seated position. He does say that standing and climbing ladders is limited to a pre-existing condition, but what we clearly have is a combination. So it brings us, of course, to 8-42-1044, which went into effect in July 1, 2008. It was one of the statutes that the Work Comp Education Association was president of and had been on the board of, had presented to the legislature, and it was accepted. And that was dealing with many of, and it was intended to deal with many of the cases that were in the appellate venue that had come down about apportionment. And that statute, as you know, states that a recovery of permanent total disability shall not be reduced from the disability as a result of work-related injury or a work-related injury combined with a genetic, congenital, or similar conditions. I don't think there's any dispute that there were genetic conditions. The question then is there a combination? Well, even the judge said her back injury has some, when he uses the word significant or uses the word primary cause, another thing, where the weakness is the primary cause of her functional limitations or her pre-existing condition, not a low back injury. Primary suggests secondary, and the secondary is the back injury. So that statute should be applied and was intended to be applied in these sections if we're going to have a public policy of encouraging disabled individuals to return to work, and if the purpose of the statute, the Work Comp Act itself, is beneficent. It's our position that neither the Industrial Claims Appeal, neither the ALJ nor the Industrial Claims Appeals Office addressed any of the concerns that arise under Section 8-42-104, although they were briefed. Now, at the ICAP, we asked that the matter be either reversed or remanded. I know in our brief we asked that it be reversed, but the decision of ICAP be reversed, but it could be remanded too, to at least give consideration to the impact of 8-42-104, and it's probably a case of first impression in that regard. So you have an opportunity to effectuate the intent of the statute and to ensure that injured, that disabled workers who return to work and do their best to return to the job market. You can't fault this lady in any way. Ms. Farmer got herself an education. When she ticketed work program didn't work, she went out on her own. Went on the internet, got a job, showed up at that job, hurt herself. And interestingly enough, it was admitted as such after the injury, and it was when the employer attempted to withdraw the general admission that we went to hearing before Judge Cromerick. His opinion clearly recognizes the pre-existing condition and says very simply, the claimant did not have this type of pain prior to December 13, 2008 and did not have a chronic low back condition, nor was she unable to perform her usual work because of a low back prior to that date. And there's no evidence of an MRI on the back, which showed a manual tear. There's no evidence of restrictions. There were no restrictions on this claimant that were given by any doctor until she injured herself in December of 2008.
Mr. O'Toole, it looks as if there's conflicting evidence. You have done a very good job of presenting some of the evidence, certainly in favor of the claimant, but it appears that there was conflicting evidence. And if that's the case, why wouldn't we, as an appellate court, defer to the fact finder?
At the risk of appearing irreverent, I want to know what that conflicting evidence was to two factors. One, did the back injury caused the claimant to have limitations? There's no conflict on that. What the conflict, and I'll tell you why, because you have a determination of a dime doctor that the back injury limits her to sitting as a job. Now, you know from your cases involving permanent total disability, if an individual can earn wages sitting, then he can be permanent totally disabled. But, you know, if you look at that, you know that there's a congenital condition, you know there's, what's the conflict? The conflict is Burnham suggesting that, contrary to what the applicable law is, that she shouldn't have worked in the first place. That is why she is not permanently and totally disabled, because she shouldn't have worked in the first place. Montoya says essentially the same thing, but that's counterfactual. She did work.
The ALJ found that the claimant was not capable of performing her job before she sustained her work injury, and that the accommodations made were necessitated by her pre-existing health conditions, not her work conditions. Was that not based on evidence in the record?
Here's the difference. I agree. I know that that's what it said. So let's think. Let's break this down. There is a basic concept that we accommodate disabled individuals. So accommodations are made. I will tell you that in the permanent total cases, it is always argued that some employer can accommodate the employee who's disabled. Now, see, I'm almost there. At any rate, I'll just say to you.
No, you have 5 minutes.
Excuse me.
You have 5 minutes.
All right. But what I'm going to say in this regard is that indeed accommodations were made. That doesn't mean she couldn't work, because in fact she did, could, and Judge Crumrick found she was capable of doing this work. And let's just assume that thereafter she has this injury, and then Dr. Haney limits her lifting, and Dr. Gronseth, who's the dime doctor, rendering an opinion on causation. He is saying that her back injury causes her to have a limitation, a functional limitation of sitting. Well, now we do have, by definition, the triggering of Section 842.104. And what I'm saying is, I really would challenge anybody reading the opinions of the ALJ or ICAO to even have attempted to address this requirement under the statute that consideration be given to disabled individuals who have returned to the workplace and that congenital conditions such as this claimant has. I have. Now, any other questions I'll be happy to answer. And for the sake of sounding argumentative, I guess I am. Thank you. Thank you.
Hey, please, the court. My name is Brad Miller. I represent Office Max, a New Hampshire insurance company. First, I want to address something that Mr. O'Toole brought up. He said that the ICAP did not address 842.104.4, and that's not accurate. On page 5 of their opinion, they specifically said that they reject the claimant's argument about the misapplication of 842.104.4. And the reason that they said that was because to have that statute work, you have to have a combination between the work injury and the genetic factors causing the permanent disability. And specifically what the ICAP said was the judge had found that they didn't combine. In fact, the sole reason for the permanent total disability was the claimant's pre-existing genetic problems. So ICAP did deal with that issue. They specifically addressed it. Before I get into the case law here, I want to talk just briefly about background. I mean, you guys have all seen this in the briefs, but this individual had muscular dystrophy starting at the age of 7, lupus, epilepsy, and had actually been disabled for 30 years under the Social Security Disability Act. She had not attempted to work in 30 years. She did try to return to work in this ticket to work program that he talked about previously. That was what was attempted. She could not find a job through that. Ultimately, she ended up at OfficeMax to try to work. In those years leading up to that, 30 years of being disabled, there's pretty sufficient evidence that the claimant was confined to her home at times. She was unable to get out of bed. She could not get out of chairs, couches. She needed help downstairs. She couldn't use a bus. Basically, she had cognitive problems as well. There was this whole host of symptoms and problems that she had had for years. And she does deserve credit for trying to come back to work, but ultimately she could not perform the work. It was very clear from the record that she couldn't. Initially, upon showing up at work, she asked for a chair. She asked for help with lifting. She was basically in tears repeatedly is what, you know, the information was. She also, there was customers that noticed that she could not do her job. So it's very clear that she could not do her job. She tried to do it. She tried to do it for just over 4 months. It did not work out. And so what Mr. O'Toole is focused on is the fact that was there a compensable injury? Yes. Was there benefits paid? Yes. But what that compensable injury is and what the division IME said about that compensable injury is an absolutely separate factual issue and legal issue from whether the permanent total disability is related to the work injury or whether it's related to the pre-existing factors. Now, this case, and this is the most important part about this case is not an apportionment case. This is a causation case, and this court, the Court of Appeals, has absolutely decided this issue before in the Seafried case. If you take a look at Seafried, that's cited in our brief at 736 P. 2nd, 1262, that is a very similar case to this. The claimant had ruptured biceps and had muscle weakness that was pre-existing from a genetic issue. And ultimately, the claimant went to court to prove permanent total disability benefits. While trying to prove that, the defense and respondents basically argued that the problem here was due to the underlying muscle disorder and it had nothing whatsoever to do with the work injury. And that is what the ALJ found, and ultimately that's what the Court of Appeals affirmed. And they said that the issue is whether there's a significant causative factor of the work injury causing the permanent total disability benefits. It makes no difference if there was a work injury, a biceps tear, that the claimant had to be out of work for the biceps tear. The question is with permanent total disability benefits, what is the causative factor? And they indicated in that case, the Court of Appeals has indicated that Seafried, that basically if the causation is that the problem with the PT is due to the pre-existing issues, then the work injury plays no role, and that's a causation determination that has nothing to do with apportionment. The claimant's attorney has focused in his brief on, in part, the United Airlines Bolin case about the full responsibility rule. That has absolutely nothing to do with what we're talking about here today. What we're talking about here today is a causation issue, not apportionment among a bunch of injuries that led to permanent total disability. In the United Airlines Bolin case, there was multiple injuries with multiple different insurance carriers that all led to permanent total disability. And what the court indicated in that case is there's a full responsibility rule for the last insurance carrier to take those benefits, the permanent total benefits, and pay them. And the reason is that they had a causative factor in causing the permanent total disability, and they were the last insurance on the line, so they take full responsibility for those benefits. The difference here is that no one has indicated that the work injury played any causative factor whatsoever in the permanent total disability. The apportionment statute, when you take a close look at it, 842.1044, that Mr. O'Toole is focused on, indicates when the work injury combines with the genetic congenital, then you basically, as an insurance company, have to pay for the entire permanent total disability claim. In this case, it did not combine. I want to focus...
Okay, and when you say it didn't combine, you're basing that on the findings of the second ALJ?
That's right.
Okay, well, can you speak to the extent that the findings of the first ALJ at least imply, if not express, that they did combine?
Because that is a different issue as to whether somebody has a compensable injury and whether they have temporary disability and permanent partial disability is a separate issue from per total. That's been made clear in the Askew case, that's been made clear in multiple cases that those are separate issues.
So are you saying that no matter what the ALJ said in the first case, it essentially has no significance in the second case because they're different issues?
That's exactly right. Now, this is a factual determination by this judge. And this judge, and I'm talking about the second case, the judge could have said that the back injury combined or the back injury played a significant causative factor under Seafried, could have made that determination. There was probably facts sufficient there for the judge to make that determination. But that is a factual determination for that judge to make. And once she made that factual determination, and she's given a wide discretion under those circumstances, the Court of Appeals has to affirm it because she's given that discretion. And again, the case law is clear. Just like in Seafried, there's no doubt in Seafried that there was a compensable injury. There's no doubt in Seafried that, you know, the claimant ruptured their biceps and had temporary disability related to that, and ultimately got a permanent partial disability rating for that biceps. But then the question becomes, once you're done with that, did that biceps tear play a role in the permanent total disability? Was there a significant causative factor or a combination under 842.104? And that did not happen here. The judge was very clear in the factual findings, and that's what I want to talk about next. If you look at that judge's factual findings, factual finding number 36, she says, there's no persuasive evidence suggests that such limitations, she's talking about the medical restrictions, are attributable to the work injury. Rather, the evidence demonstrated the claimant was disabled for 30 years prior to accepting the employment with the employer. That was her factual finding. She also clarified that in her conclusions of law under number 9, where she basically repeats the same language. So she was given the discretion to make this decision. It's a separate issue, under, just like Seafried, separate issue from whether there was a compensable injury with permanency. This is a separate injury. She was given that discretion, and she made that factual determination, and therefore it must be affirmed. One of the other issues here, give me a second, is that the claimant keeps saying that it's factually inconsistent for the judge or these experts to say that the claimant was not employable before she went back to work. Well, she wasn't employable. We see this all the time. People try to come back to work. She deserves credit for making that, after 30 years, for making that attempt. But it was clear she couldn't go back to work. They reduced her hours from 32 to 18 almost immediately within a couple of months because she couldn't do the work. She was in tears all the time. She needed help trying to lift things and do things. And it's unfortunate, her situation is unfortunate, but the fact of the matter is that she was not employable, which is why she had been on SSDI benefits for 30 years. One last thing that I want to talk about is, I think from a public policy perspective, to overturn Seafried, and to overturn this case, because we believe it is Seafried. I think to rule differently on this case, you'd have to overturn Seafried. It would make it difficult to encourage employers to hire people in this situation. OfficeMax took somebody that they knew had been out of work for years. They brought her back to work. She obviously couldn't do the job, and unfortunately she had an injury. But if you're going to say, under these circumstances where the medical restrictions are caused by, ultimately the permanent medical restrictions are caused by the pre-existing condition, that somehow we would have to pay that, I think that would have a chilling effect. But anyway, I think in conclusion here, I've been through the majority of the arguments, and I don't think there's anything real specifically to talk about other than, again, this is not an apportionment case. It has nothing to do with apportionment. That's what claimant's attorneys or the appellant's attorney is trying to tell you. But it has nothing to do with the Bowen case, United case. It has nothing to do with 842.104.4. It is a causation case. It is within the discretion of the judge. The judge made that decision, and she has given wide discretion, and therefore it has to be affirmed. Thank you.
Members of the panel, I do appreciate counsel's argument about causation, because in fact, the dime doctor, whose opinion on causation with regard to the functional cause of limiting the claim to sitting, is one that was never challenged. So that causation establishes that the back injury limits the claimant to sitting position. Number two, Seafried was passed in 1986. It did not have benefit of the statute, which my colleagues and I worked on to get passed, in effective July 2008. I suggest that perhaps there would have been at least a discussion of this a little more than what was suggested by counsel. What I'm trying to tell you about the opinions is there's no discussion of how we can ignore that cause of claimants being limited to sitting when combined with the genetic problems was the result, ended up together causing PT.
But what about employers' argument that you've got apples and oranges here, that the issue in before the second ALJ is qualitatively different from the issue before the first ALJ, and although that some of the evidence may overlap, we really look at the second ALJ's decision for sufficiency with great deference, and we ignore what the first ALJ found.
Well, if there was a conflict in the evidence, and there was any dispute that indeed there were genetic conditions which were impacted my back injury, perhaps my argument would have to fail. But in fact, both judges found pre-existing conditions, and the dime doctor, which governs this case with regard to causation on a back injury, shows that the claim was limited to sitting. So therefore, there was an impact on her earning any wages. And what he's saying is correct up to a point. But you have to get a little beyond that. In fact, I believe that it's our position that Section 8-42.104 requires more than saying, well, we're going to ignore the prior judge. We're just going to go forward. Because what the prior judge, look, if you look at the ruling and look at those orders, I'll read just one little section. I know I'm almost out of time. Claimant has significant history that of pre-existing condition that disabled her. Paragraph 7, conclusions of the law. Well, don't disagree with that. But the fact is she got back to work. She was working at the time she injured herself. So she was capable of work. And in fact, the Social Security Administration on several occasions said in 1973, that she was capable of working, and that she could do sedentary or light work. Those are facts too, but they're not discussed anywhere. But anyway, thank you.
We appreciate the arguments of both counsel. The case stands submitted. Counsel are excused. We will issue a written opinion in due course.